Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Hi, welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I'm the Medical Science Officer at Medicom. In this episode of this podcast, Medicom will cover six presentations from the European Society of Medical Oncology, or ESMO as it's better known, which was held virtually between the 16th and the 21st of September 2021. At the end of these six presentations, there will be an interview provided by Professor Javier Cortez of the DESTINY-Breast03 trial that was presented in the Presidential Symposium at ESMO. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and one of the more interesting breast cancer trials that was discussed at ESMO this year was the final overall survival analysis of the Phase 3 MONALEESA 2 study. Now, this was presented by Professor Gabriel Hortabagi from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And this was presented for the late-breaking results, and it was looking at the final overall survival analysis of this trial. This looked at the investigational drug ribociclib, which was given oral at 600 milligrams daily with 3 weeks on and a 1 week off schedule, plus the aromatase inhibitor letrozole, which was again oral but 2.5 milligrams provided daily. And this was compared to a cohort that was given placebo plus letrozole. So the primary endpoint of MONALEESA 2 was met and had been reported previously that showed that ribociclib plus letrozole improved progression-free survival of postmenopausal women with hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. Furthermore, the results of the MONALEESA 7 trial also showed that premenopausal women with advanced hormone receptor positive HER2 negative breast cancer also showed an improved progression-free survival as well as an overall survival benefit. So because overall survival was a key secondary endpoint of the MONALEESA 2 trial, this was a very anticipated result with regard to the long-term overall survival data, which was just presented for the first time at ESMO. The cohort had a median follow-up of 79.7 months, and the final analysis of the MONALEESA showed that a median overall survival of 63.9 months with frontline ribociclib and letrozole compared with 51.4 months with letrozole alone. The estimated six-year survival rate was 44.2% with ribociclib versus 32% for placebo. MONALEESA 2 is the first trial to demonstrate a survival advantage with a frontline CDK4 or 6 inhibitor in postmenopausal patients with a hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative status in their advanced breast cancer. No new safety signals were observed in this longer follow-up, and adverse events were consistent with all of the earlier reported MONALEESA trial results. So Professor Hortabagi concluded, quote, "I am very encouraged that metastatic breast cancer patients may have a treatment option that extends survival, delays chemotherapy treatment, and preserves their quality of life. To date, this is the very first report of statistically significant and clinically meaningful overall survival with a frontline CDK4 and 6 inhibitor in postmenopausal patients with hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative advanced breast cancer." Certainly one of the most looked forward to talks was presented by Professor Javier Cortez from the International Breast Cancer Center in Barcelona, Spain. And these were the pre-specified interim results of the DESTINY-Breast03 trial, which looked at trastuzumab, deruxtecan, T-DXd, in a head-to-head trial with trastuzumab emtansine, or T-DM1. This was a global head-to-head open-label randomized phase 3 DESTINY-Breast03 study, and the interim analysis was presented, as I mentioned previously, by Professor Cortez. It evaluated the safety and efficacy of T-DXd in 261 patients versus T-DM1 in 263 patients with HER2-positive, unresectable, and/or metastatic breast cancer previously treated with trastuzumab and a taxane. The primary endpoint of DESTINY-Breast03 was progression-free survival based on blinded independent central review, and secondary efficacy endpoints included overall survival, the PFS based on investigator assessment, objective response rate, duration response, clinical benefit rate, and safety. So in the T-DXd cohort, there was a 15.5 months of follow-up, and the T-DM1 group, there was 13.9 months of follow-up. And the blinded independent central review determined that the median PFS for patients treated with T-DXd was not reached compared with 6.8 months for the TDM1, and that provided a hazard ratio of 0.28 and a highly significant p-value. The key secondary endpoint of progression-free survival assessed by investigators showed that patients treated with T-DXd experienced a threefold improvement in PFS of 25.1 months versus 7.2 months with TDM1. And that gave a hazard ratio of 0.26. The PFS benefit was consistent across all key subgroups of patients treated with T-DXd, including those with a history of stable brain metastases. So differences in the estimated 12-month overall survival was 94.1% for the T-DXd group and 85.9% for those patients treated with T-DM1. It did not cross the pre-specified boundary for significance, but it did provide an interesting trend that will show when the data become more mature, perhaps a significant difference. The current hazard ratio is 0.56. The safety profile of the most common adverse events with T-DXd and the DESTINY-Breast03 was actually consistent with previous data, with no new safety concerns being reported. Interstitial lung disease, of course, is a major concern for these patients on T-DXd. It was reported in about 10% of the patients, versus 2% in the TDM1 arm, yet the numbers were lower than previously described trials using TDXD, so that was at least reassuring. So the discussant was Dr. Shanu Modi from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. She declared, quote, "The efficacy seen in this trial is unprecedented," end quote. If you'd like to hear more about this trial, there'll be an interview with the presenter, Professor Javier Cortez, at the end of this podcast. Moving on to melanoma, stage 2 melanoma specifically, the first interim analysis of the KEYNOTE-716 trial suggested that adjuvant pembrolizumab could be superior to the standard of care observation for adults and children with completely resected high-risk melanoma. So patients with stage 2B or 2C melanoma are at high risk of disease recurrence, and survival outcomes are actually not unlike those with stage 3A and 3B melanoma. In patients with stage 3 melanoma, we know that adjuvant therapy with pembrolizumab has prolonged recurrence-free survival as well as distant metastasis-free survival. The phase 3 double-blinded KEYNOTE-716 trial evaluated pembrolizumab versus placebo in patients with resected stage 2B and 2C melanoma. It was presented by Dr. Jason Luke of the UPMC Hillman Cancer Center in Pennsylvania in the United States. And there were a total of 976 patients enrolled in this, 64% of whom had stage 2B disease, 34.8% had stage 2C, and they had all had complete resection of their cutaneous disease and with negative sentinel lymph node biopsies. They were randomized 1:1 to either pembrolizumab or placebo every 3 weeks for 17 cycles up to 1 year. Treatment continued until disease recurrence or unacceptable toxicity. The primary endpoint was recurrent-free survival per investigator assessment. Secondary points were distant metastasis-free survival, overall survival, safety, and quality of life. At medium follow-up of 14.4 months, pembrolizumab significantly improved the recurrent-free survival versus placebo with a hazard ratio of 0.65, and the median was not reached for either arm. The 12-month RFS rate was 90.5% versus 83.1%. At data cutoff, 11.1% of the patients treated with pembrolizumab had a recurrence versus 16.8% of the patients treated with placebo. Pembrolizumab almost halved the distant recurrent rate, 4.7% versus 7.8%. The incidence of greater than or equal to 3 adverse events was higher with pembrolizumab than with placebo, both for any cause adverse events, that was 26% versus 17% roughly, and for drug-related adverse events, which was 16% versus 4.3% roughly. Altogether, 15.3% of patients discontinued pembrolizumab due to a drug-related adverse event, compared with 2.5% receiving placebo. Immune-mediated adverse events occurred in 36.2% versus 8.4% of patients, most commonly hypothyroidism, which was 15.7% versus 3.5% in the placebo arm, and hyperthyroidism, which was 10.4% versus 0.6%. Most of those adverse events were grade 1 or 2 in severity. The quality of life was maintained with both adjuvant pembrolizumab and placebo. Of course, I have to always ask how you compare quality of life for a patient who goes in to have placebo injected every few weeks. Quote, "Adjuvant pembrolizumab is an effective treatment option with a favorable benefit-risk profile for patients with high-risk stage 2 melanoma," concluded Dr. Luke. Moving on to lung cancer, the phase 3 Caspian trial demonstrated first-line treatment with durvalumab plus platinum etoposide, EP, to improve overall survival versus EP alone in patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer, so SCLC. The 3-year median follow-up data was presented by Dr. Luis Paz Ares from the Hospital Universitario, 12th of October in Spain. So in Caspian, 805 patients with treatment-naive extensive stage SCLC were randomized 1:1:1 to receive durvalumab plus EP every 3 weeks, durvalumab plus tremelimumab plus EP every 3 weeks, or EP alone every 3 weeks. Patients in the immunotherapy arms received 4 cycles of EP plus durvalumab plus or minus tremelimumab followed by maintenance durvalumab every 4 weeks. The primary endpoints were overall survival for durvalumab plus EP versus EP and for durvalumab plus tremelimumab plus EP versus EP. At a median follow-up of 39.4 months at this point, which is 86% maturity, durvalumab plus EP continued to demonstrate improved overall survivals versus EP with a hazard ratio of 0.71, highly significant p-value. Median overall survival was 12.9 versus 10.5 months. At 24 months, 22.9 versus 13.9% of patients were alive, and at 36 months, 17.6% versus 5.8% of the patients were alive when looking at durvalumab plus EP versus EP alone. Durvalumab plus tremelimumab plus EP continued to numerically improve overall survival versus EP alone, and that had a hazard ratio of 0.81. Median overall survival was 10.4 months versus 10.5 months. At 24 months, 22.9% versus 13.9% of the patients were alive, and at 36 months, 15.3% and 5.8% of patients were alive with durvalumab plus tremelimumab plus EP versus EP alone. Safety profiles were actually consistent with all previous data collected earlier about these combinations. Dr. Paz Ares concluded, quote, 3 times more patients were estimated to be alive at 3 years follow-up when treated with durvalumab plus EP versus EP alone, further establishing durvalumab plus EP as a standard of care for the first-line treatment of extensive stage SCLC. Addition of tremelimumab to durvalumab plus EP does not seem to further improve overall survival. End quote. Some interesting new data was presented with regard to esophageal and gastric cancers and the consistent benefit of using anti-PD-1 therapy against those cancers. And this was based on the updated results from the CheckMate 649 study, which in short continued to show improvement of overall survival with durvalumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone in patients with advanced gastric cancer or gastroesophageal junction cancer or esophageal adenocarcinoma. So fluoropyrimidines plus platinum-based chemotherapy are the standard first-line treatment for unresectable, advanced, or metastatic HER2-negative gastric cancers or gastroesophageal junction cancers. And they usually result in quite poor survival, with a median overall survival of less than 1 year. However, recently results from the randomized global phase 3 CheckMate 649 study really did show that there was a superior overall survival with first-line nivolumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone in patients with advanced gastric cancers or gastroesophageal junction cancers, leading to the U.S. FDA approval recently. This was a presentation by Dr. Yelena Yanjigian from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in the United States in New York, presented the updated results from the CheckMate 649, and this had a longer follow-up for nivolumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone, and the first results for nivolumab plus ipilimumab versus chemotherapy. In CheckMate 649, 2,031 patients with previously untreated unresectable, advanced, or metastatic gastric cancer or gastroesophageal junction cancers were enrolled regardless of PD-L1 expression. Patients with known HER2-positive status were excluded. Patients were randomized to nivolumab at 360 milligrams every 3 weeks, plus chemo, and that was Zelox every 3 weeks or FOLFOX for every 2 weeks, plus nivolumab plus ipilimumab, or chemotherapy alone. In the nivolumab plus chemotherapy group, there were 789 patients. In the patient group given nivolumab plus ipilimumab, that was 409 patients, and the chemotherapy alone was 833 patients. The dual primary endpoints were overall survival and progression-free survival for nivolumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy in patients with PD-L1 combined positive scores of greater than or equal to 5. And there were 955 patients in that cohort. Hierarchically tested secondary endpoints included overall survival in nivolumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy in patients with CPS greater than or equal to 1, and overall survival in nivolumab plus ipilimumab plus chemotherapy. Nivolumab plus chemotherapy continued to show improvement in the overall survival versus chemotherapy alone, with an additional 12 months of follow-up from the primary analysis. And the median overall survival was 14.4 months versus 11.1 months, with a hazard ratio of 0.70 in the patients whose CPS was greater than or equal to 5. And 13.8 months versus 11.6 months in all randomized patients, with a hazard ratio of 0.79. Two-year overall survival rates were 31% versus 19% in the CPS group greater than or equal to 5, and 28 versus 19% in all randomized patients. Median overall survival in MSI, so microsatellite and stable high patients, there were 44 of those patients, was 38.7 months versus 12.3 months with a hazard ratio of 0.38. The secondary endpoint of overall survival in patients with CPS greater than or equal to 5 for nivolumab plus ipilimumab versus chemotherapy was not met in the CPS greater than or equal to 5 patient cohort. Median survival in the MSI high patients, so the microsatellite and stable high patients, was not reached versus 10.0 months in the MSI normal groups. No new safety signals were identified. Dr. Zhangji Jian ended by saying, "These updated results from CheckMate 649 continue to demonstrate clinically meaningful long-term survival benefit from first-line nivolumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone and an acceptable safety profile. This further supports the use of nivolumab plus chemotherapy as a new standard first-line treatment in patients with advanced gastric cancer, gastroesophageal junction cancers, and esophageal adenocarcinomas." Dr. Enriqueta Felipe from the Valdebron Institute of Oncology in Spain presented additional results from exploratory analyses in the Empower 10 trial. So going back to the rationale, despite treatment with curative intent, up to 60% of patients with stage 1 through 3 non-small cell lung cancers still experience disease relapse. The Empower 10 trial was the first randomized phase 3 trial to show significant disease-free survival improvement with adjuvant cancer therapy, so this was atezolizumab, after adjuvant chemotherapy in patients with early stage resected NSCLC. Enrolled patients had completely resected stage 2B or 3A NSCLC and ECOG performance status of 0 or 1, and a total of 1,280 patients received up to 4 21-day cycles of cisplatin-based chemotherapy, plus pemetrexed, docetaxel, gemcitabine, or vinorelbine. Next, 1,005 patients without progression after adjuvant chemotherapy were randomized 1:1 to atezolizumab at 1,200 milligrams every 3 weeks for 16 cycles or until disease relapse or unacceptable toxicity was observed. The other arm received best supportive care. The primary endpoint was disease-free survival, which hierarchically tested in PD-L1 with TC greater than or equal to 1% in stage 2 or 3A patients, with 476 patients being in that cohort, and then to all randomized stage 2 and 3A patients, which was a total of 882 patients, and then an intention to treat population, which is 1,005 patients. As previously reported, the median DFS was significantly improved by atezolizumab in PD-L1 positive patients with a hazard ratio of 0.66. and in all randomized patients with a hazard ratio of 0.79, but not in the intention to treat population, which, although it had a hazard ratio of 0.81, did not quite meet significance. At ESMO this year, Dr. Philippe presented the additional results from the Empower 10 trial. In all randomized stage 2 or 3A patients, DFS improvement was seen with increasing PD-L1 expression, and so if you stratified them into the percentages of PD-L1 expression, you could see that if it was less than 1%, there was a hazard ratio of 0.97, so hardly any difference whatsoever, 383 patients in that analysis. If you took it between 1 and 49% positivity, there was a hazard ratio of 0.87. And if you had greater than or equal to 50% positive PD-L1, then the hazard ratio was 0.43. And there are 229 patients in that cohort. So time to relapse appeared to favor the tislelizumab arm over the best supported care arm in the PD-L1 group in any patients with PD-L1 positive status, with minimal differences seen in the all randomized and ITT populations. A higher rate of post-relapse immunotherapy was seen in the best supportive care arm. Based on these additional results from the Empower 10, Dr. Philippe concluded that in the interim DFS analysis, relapse rate was higher in the best supportive care arm versus the atezolizumab arm. However, there was no clear difference in the pattern of relapse between the arms among patients who relapsed. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we had the terrific opportunity to interview Professor Javier Cortez from Barcelona about the DESTINY-Breast03 trial, which I talked about earlier in this program. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Cortez. Can you comment on the spectacular efficacy data from the DESTINY-Breast03 trial you presented at ESMO?
Yeah, thank you very much, Rachel. So, yeah, I agree. As you very well said, we presented great data from DESTINY-Breast03, which is basically a randomized phase 3 trial, which tried to compare T-DXd, a new antibody drug conjugate, trastuzumab deruxtecan, compared with T-DM1, and it was presented at ESMO 2021. As you know, we have made terrific improvements in the prognosis of HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. However, the great majority of our patients will die because of the disease. So even though we have, as I said before, great improvements, this is still an unmet need. So if we look at the history of HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, we realized that the standard of care in the first-line setting is clearly the combination of trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and taxane based on the CLEOPATRA trial with a median progression-free survival in the range of 18.7 months. Also, it's quite clear that the standard of care in the second-line setting is T-DM1 based on the phenomenal data in the EMILIA clinical randomized phase 3 trial, with a median progression-free survival of 9.6 months. However, it is true that this trial was published many, many years ago by Sunil Verma in 2012. So great improvements have been achieved since that time. And when we look at the treatment landscape and the more recent clinical trials and real-world evidence studies, we have seen that with T-DM1, the median PFS now ranges between 6 to 7 months at best. Indeed, in some randomized phase 2 trials, like in K2, the T-DM1 control arm did have a 6.8 months median PFS. Very good treatments are also upcoming, and we have data from the DESTINY-Breast01, a large phase 2 study with trastuzumab deruxtecan with T-DXd, looking at this drug in the third line or beyond. So in this heavily treated population, the overall response rate was in the range of 61%, median PFS in the range of 19.4 months, and also at ESMO, we updated the data of overall survival within the range of 30 months, which I think is superb for this heavily pretreated population. So because of the different characteristics between these two antibody drug conjugates, T-DXd and T-DM1, basically with a very interesting bystander effect, the tumor selective cleavable linker, the drug to antibody ratio, and the differences in payload, a head-to-head randomized phase 3 trial was conducted called DESTINY-Breast03. In brief, in patients with unresectable or metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer, previously treated with taxanes on trastuzumab, patients were randomized in a 1-to-1 fashion to T-DM1 or to T-DXd. Key primary endpoint was progression-free survival, key secondary endpoint was overall survival, and other secondary endpoints were overall response rate, duration of response, progression-free survival according to investigator, primary endpoint was according to the blinded and independent central review, and safety. We presented at ESMO the interim analysis for progression-free survival, and based on the efficacy boundary for superiority, the Independent Data Monitoring Committee recommended to unblind the study in July the 30th this year. A total of 524 patients were randomized, and of interest regarding baseline characteristics, about 20% of patients did have history of brain metastasis, and about 70% of patients did have visceral disease. 89% of patients did have HER2 3+, according to the central analysis that was mandatory to be enrolled in this study. Also of interest, 8 to 10% of patients did not receive prior treatment for metastatic disease. We should not forget that these patients received treatment in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting, but the disease-free interval was very short, less than 6 months. So this was considered as one line of prior therapy. What about the median progression-free survival primary endpoint? It was 6.8 months with T-DM1. It was not reached with T-DXd. Hazard ratio 0.28, and the p-value was 7.8 by 10 to minus 22. 12 months, PFS rate was 34% for T-DM1 and 76% for T-DXd. According to the investigator, the hazard ratio was 0.26. When you look at the PFS in all key subgroups, either hormone receptor positive or negative, prior pertuzumab or not, visceral or not visceral disease, prior lines of therapy, and brain metastasis, yes or no, all subgroups benefit identically. The key secondary endpoint, 12-month overall survival was 94% with T-DXd, 86% with T-DM1, hazard ratio 0.56, p-value 0.007, but this did not cross the pre-specified boundary for superiority at this interim analysis. Lastly, overall response rate was observed in about 80% of patients treated with T-DXd compared with 34% of patients treated with T-DM1.
That 80% objective response rate in previously treated patients is pretty impressive.
No, you're right. I mean, it's not only the 80%, as you pointed out, it's also the 16% of patients having complete response, you know, and which is even much more impressive, in my opinion, is that only 3 patients in the T-DXd arm, 1.1%, did have progressive disease as best response, compared with 17.5% in the T-DM1 arm.
So why is it that T-DXd is so much better than T-DM1?
Well, yeah, well, I cannot answer, of course, that question, but we can just discuss the differences between these both drugs. And as I said before, which I think is very important, at least there are, in my opinion, 7 to 8 differences, but I would like to highlight 4. The payload is completely different. It's topo 1 inhibitor. With T-DXd, it is an anti-microtubule agent with T-DM1. Also, the high drug-to-antibody ratio, 8 to 1 with T-DXd, 3.5 to 1 with T-DM1. Also, the tumor selectivity cleavable linker. We should remember that T-DXd is metabolized, is broken based on the, or thanks to the cathepsins B and L. And these are much more expressed in tumor cells compared than normal cells. And finally, the bystander anti-tumor effect. So once the payload is broken, the topo 1 inhibitor can cross the membrane and can affect the neighboring cells, something that does not happen with T-DM1.
Obviously, we're all wondering what this does in first-line metastatic disease, but also what about early disease? Can we think about this as, say, post-neoadjuvant for residual disease?
No, that's a great question. There are 2 ongoing clinical trials which are, in my opinion, key. One of them is in the first-line setting metastatic. So basically, it is a Cleopatra-based regimen compared with T-DXd, compared with T-DXd plus pertuzumab. And the other one, as you pointed out, is in the adjuvant setting after non-PCR based on neoadjuvant approach. In, again, face-to-face against T-DM1. Well, I don't know which the results will be, but I expect that, of course, T-DXd will be superior to T-DM1 also in that setting.
The data you presented supports moving T-DXd to the second line instead of the third line. Do you think we can give T-DM1 to our patients after T-DXd?
That's, Rachel, a lovely question. Of course, the answer is we do not know, but this is something that had happened in the history of breast cancer in particular and cancer in general. When you have a good drug and this drug move up, what about the other ones? They have to move after. So I think that we, of course, will need to look at the activity of T-DM1 in real-world evidence studies to see how it looks like. I think that I might expect some degree of activity because of the payload. It's completely different. But of course, I don't know if we will have this 34-35% of responses that we observed in Emilia, very similar to, also to Theresa. So this is something that we have to see in the future months or years.
At ESMO, there was also a highlighted trial called the TULIP trial with trastuzumab duocarmazine. Can you put that or those results into context with the DESTINY-Breast03 data?
Well, I think that, again, it's an excellent question. What about Tuli? What about trastuzumab duocarmazine? The answer, of course, is we don't know. We have to see what happens afterwards. But let me make the same comment as before. So if we do not know the activity of TDM1 after T-DXd, we do not know the activity of trastuzumab duocarmazine after T-DXd. So when you look at the TULIP data, the PFS was achieved, has a ratio 0.64. But two key aspects, in my opinion. The first one is that the overall response rate was identical. It was 30% with physician's choice. It was 28% with trastuzumab duocarmazine. So no improvement in overall response rate. And the second one is the toxicity. Almost 80% of patients, 78.1%, did have any grade of eye toxicity, being grade 3 or higher in 21.2% of patients. Also, we should not forget that 2% of patients did have fatal cases, fatal events. So I think this is a tough drug that we, of course, have to learn how to manage it. So my answer is very clear. We do not know, but in my opinion, TN1 is a better option to be explored compared with trastuzumab duocarmazine at this time after T-DXd.
One thing that puzzled me was that although the interstitial lung disease numbers were actually quite low on this DESTINY-Breast03 trial, lower than previous trials, there was a fairly high discontinuation rate. Could you talk to that, please?
Well, that's an excellent question. It is true that when we look at the discontinuations, it was in the range of 12 to 13% with T-DXd, it was 5% with TDM1. So it's about 7 to 8 points higher. The great majority of this difference could be because of the ILD pneumonitis. By the way, the great majority of them being grade 1 or 2. Only 2 patients, 0.8%, did have grade 3 pneumonitis and no grade 4, grade 5. So I think that we have to know how to manage this grade 2. Pneumonitis ILD. But I agree, I think that we have to learn again how to use this drug more in the future. But nevertheless, even having these 13% of discontinuations, the impressive improvement in activity, in my opinion, makes sense to consider this drug as the next standard of care in the second line setting.
Thank you so much for your comments.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Happy to be with you today.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today's podcast. I thought ESMO was a terrific meeting this year, and I think that they do a great job recognizing the different needs that are required to hold a virtual meeting versus an in-person meeting. And they did a fantastic job making this as interactive as and as interesting as possible with really late-breaking abstracts that were stunning. So I hope you enjoyed listening to this. Stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.